There are lots of things that a computer can do, an AI can do, a lot better than humans. It can clearly play chess better, it can beat us at Go, and maybe even the game of Jeopardy. But are there some things that humans can do better than AI when AI is placed head-to-head with the human? That's the topic today on Mind Matters.
Welcome to Mind Matters, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. We are continuing our talk with Eric Holloway on the interface and the relative abilities of humans and AI. He's the perfect person to talk about it. Quick introduction. Eric Holloway has a PhD in electrical and computer engineering. He is a current captain of the United States Air Force, where when he was on active duty, he served in the U.S. and Afghanistan. He's a co-editor of the book Naturalism and Its Alternatives in Scientific Methodologies. He's an associate fellow of the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. As I mentioned last time, I have collaborated with Eric on a number of projects, and I can think of no one more knowledgeable to talk to than Eric on this. So, Eric, let's continue our talk about the relationship between the capabilities of AI and humans. You educated me about something called Foldit, which was really an interesting illustration of computers versus, I guess, crowdsourcing. Could you explain Foldit?
Yes, yeah. Foldit came out of a university project aimed at folding proteins more rapidly. And I don't know the mechanics behind protein folding, but it's really computationally intensive. So originally they wanted to rent people's spare CPU time. So if you just have your desktop sitting idle on your desk, they wanted to use your CPU and fold some proteins. And they had a huge amount of people donating their CPUs, but they also didn't get very much out of it. On the other hand, while their programs ran on people's computers, they displayed these fancy screensavers, and so people could watch the programs do the protein folding. And as they watched, they would see, oh, the computer actually would make lots of mistakes or not see something really obvious. And so taking this, the inventors of Foldit turned their screensaver into a game. So people, instead of just the CPUs folding protein, the people would be folding protein using this game they came up with. And they actually achieved major breakthroughs this way. They were able to figure out things that eluded scientists and supercomputers for decades after just like a year of this Foldit game that people were playing. And this was all complete amateurs too. Like there are no scientific experts involved in the playing of the game. So that was the really fascinating thing, is that a team of amateurs got much better results than just a few experts or even actually the whole world full of experts and supercomputers.
I am currently reading the book by Jay Richards, his most recent book, and he talked about crowdsourcing and some of the amazing things that you can do with crowdsourcing. He said, for example, you could go to a county fair and you could have a jar of jelly beans, and everybody comes along and they guess the number of beans, the jelly beans that are in the jar. And they find out that if they do the average of all of these different guesses, they get pretty close to the number of jelly beans which are in the jar. So there is there's clearly a power in this idea of crowdsourcing. And I have read about accolades to the Foldit program. And the fact that humans could do it was just an incredible result. And people were just astonished at the performance. One of the things that I think can be done with natural computing and AI is to look at creativity. Creativity is something which humans can do, which computers can't do. And it seems that it's something which is potentially testable. And I know that you actually did some of this testing in an attempt to compare them. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Right. And this was in an area known as machine learning. So with machine learning, you throw an algorithm at a bunch of data, and an algorithm tries to find some kind of pattern in the data. But it turns out that in order to do this in general, you would have to have something that's non-algorithmic, something that relies on what's known as Solomonov induction. So based on this idea, I thought, well, if humans are capable of these non-algorithmic feats, then by including a human in the loop, we'd be able to derive better machine learning models than just a purely algorithmic approach.
Okay, and if I remember right, you used something called, was it Amazon Turk?
Right.
In order to get to get your work done. So the idea is, where do you get your crowd? So you had this puzzle, and you were trying to solve it by machine intelligence, but you also wanted to present it to this crowd, which you paid on Amazon Turk. And what was the basic results of doing that?
Well, I wasn't able to get better accuracy than like the best machine learning algorithms out there. But the people were able to come up with simpler models that still were as accurate as like more basic machine learning techniques.
I know that you've attended some crowdsourcing conferences and talked to some of the people. And this idea of using people in the loop, in other words, I guess a type of crowdsourcing, is something which is prevalent across the industry, people doing creative sort of things. I think the people on the other side that would look at your result would say, hey, you know what? Dr. Holloway is using an algorithm that is outdated. Someday we'll have an algorithm that's a lot better than what he uses. So how do you respond to this idea of algorithm of the gaps?
Right. This is something I saw at the crowdsourcing conference too. Like, it was really clear from a practical standpoint that algorithms just could not meet what humans can do. And so they always had to have humans in the loop to achieve the results they need. But they also always thought that's just because we haven't found the key algorithm yet. There always is some algorithm out there that will do what people currently do. And so this seems just like something you can't falsify. Like, it's always out there. So what can you do to show there's no algorithm? Well, there are limits on size and time in what an algorithm can actually do. And so just a basic implication of that is that if humans take less space or less time to do an equivalent action, then they can't be an algorithm.
Do you think that we'll ever be able to test the ability of humans to create above and beyond that of machines, which I don't think are able to create?
Yes, I believe that's possible, and I, in fact, think I came up with something like that, but I haven't quite analyzed all the math behind it. But yeah, in theory, it's possible. Like, you can be generating puzzles from a huge space that's impossible to fit within the known universe, and in order to crack those puzzles efficiently, you'd have to have an algorithm that was also the size of the universe. And humans not being the size of the universe, if they could crack those puzzles, then they would not be an algorithm.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I wonder about with AI, and you and I have talked about, is once the human creativity comes into the picture, that the humans discover an algorithm, and then the algorithm is out there. So the creative aspect is actually generating the algorithm. But then it's almost, I'm getting a little technical here, but it's almost like a quantum wave, and you don't know what the heck's going on, and creativity comes and it collapses into the algorithm or the procedure that you come up with. Tesla did this with the induction motor. We have Friedrich Gauss coming up with some great mathematical ideas this way. And once the algorithm, once the design comes up, people look at it and they go, well, of course. And I've had that happen. I have struggled and I've had these great ideas. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is really great. I don't know where this idea came from, but it is really incredible. And I show it to colleagues and they go, well, yeah, of course, because it's so obvious. So in a way, it's it looks like in order to test for creativity, we're going to have to overcome that problem. So I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but that's kind of my view on the topic. Let's talk about creativity and what jobs are safe from AI. Everybody is worried about different AI computer programs taking over. We no longer have travel agents. Taxi drivers are not going to be around very much longer because of Uber and Lyft, great technological advantages. Truck drivers are all concerned about these driverless cars and trucks taking over. What is your view of the near future in terms of jobs that are safe from AI?
Well, in order for AI to work well, it has to work within a very narrowly constrained environment. So the ability of humans to create information also is what makes possible most jobs that are out there currently. Like to be a janitor, you have to be able to manipulate this fairly complex object through a huge number of dimensions to accomplish very specific goals. And to translate that into a computer program is essentially impossible. So a lot of jobs out there in and of themselves aren't really things you can replace with algorithms, especially, ironically, blue-collar work. Because blue-collar work tends to be taking place in the physical world, so there's a huge number of dimensions you'd have to take care of.
Really?
So, okay. Yeah. So now you could replace those jobs if you constrain the environment for the robot or AI to work in. So if instead of a janitor, you somehow turn your building into something that like sprayed water everywhere to clean everything and had suction holes to put trash in and stuff like that, then that'd be really simple to manage with an AI, but it's also no longer as complex as the problem that your janitor was solving. So you've only replaced the janitor because you've changed the job.
You have a name for this that you put in your notes, Moravec's paradox?
Right, yeah. This is something that they found out pretty early on in AI research. Originally, they thought, okay, we'll crack the AI algorithm, and then we'll first of all start with figuring out how to do like simple things that little kids can do, and then we'll work our way up into adulthood until we can turn our AI into like a financial assistant or something. But what they found out is the opposite is true. In fact, the financial advisor's job is probably easier than like a baby learning language. That's actually a much more trivial thing for AI to handle than pretty much any task your child learns. And they call that Moravec's paradox.
Interesting. Moravec. I hadn't heard about that. Again, I'm reading Jay Richards' book, and he talks about Moravec's paradox also. Let me ask you, final question. People talk about the tipping point. They talk about the singularity. The singularity is when computers take over. And everybody, in fact, I'm listening to Ray Kurzweil's book. I don't read anymore. I listen. Listening to Ray Kurzweil's book, he says we are in an exponential rise in terms of technology and AI. This is typically true of many technologies, but that exponential increase can't keep increasing. It can't do that. And usually it's an exponential rise is actually the beginning of a so-called sigmoid curve. So you have an exponential rise and then it keeps on going and then it flattens out. We see this in like population explosion. Heck, I remember when I was a kid going to grammar school, we used to get this weekly paper called the Weekly Reader, and they were saying that, oh my goodness, the world population is going to be such that by the year 2000, there's going to be, you know, one person per square inch on the earth. And that was just an extrapolation out. There was a hilarious article in the Journal of Irreproducible Results, which was a joke journal. But they were saying that we need to ban National Geographic because it's printed on this really heavy paper. Subscriptions are increasing exponentially. And if you extrapolate this exponential increase that goes on forever and ever, pretty soon there will be continents sinking and all sorts of catastrophe in the entire world. So it's very clear that this exponential increase can't go on forever. Nobody knows when it's going to stop. Could you address, and if it doesn't stop, there's going to be some sort of peak at some point. Could you address that? Is there going to be an AI peak? And what happens when we hit the AI peak? And how far is it away if you look in your crystal ball?
Right. Well, so AI is computation, so it depends on how fast our computers work. And so based on what we were talking about previously, that there is no AI algorithm that can do what humans do, So then that means there's a limit to any AI algorithm that's out there, and that limit is how fast the computer is. And we also know that computers can only increase in speed up to a point, because the speed increases comes from shrinking the components, and they can only get so small.
This is Moore's law, right? This is the idea that the number of transistors per square inch doubles every year or so.
Right. Okay. But since their reality is not infinitely divisible, then that can only happen for so many years before it stops.
You have to eventually get down to the size of an atom or electron or something.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the fundamental limit on AI. At some point, we'll hit the speed and memory thresholds, and so then that will be peak AI.
Okay, and when do you think that's going to happen? I don't like forecasting too much. Niels Bohr said that forecasting is dangerous, especially if it's about the future. But I'm going to ask you for a forecast anyway. When do you think this peak computation is going to hit?
I think the farthest out it could be would be about 50 years. And the reason why I say this is the finest granularity I think they can get with transistors is something called quantum dot computation.
Yes.
And so if you compare that size to what we currently have and extrapolate Moore's law, then that just gives us about 50 years before they saturate the quantum dot level.
And what happens when we hit this AI peak? What's the function? What is going to happen then?
Well, when we hit the AI peak, then our algorithms, that's going to be it for in terms of their raw performance. So the only way you can get more out of your algorithms is going to be by adding information to them. So at that point, it'll become very, very clear that a human in the loop is the only way to move forward with computational improvements.
Okay. So humans in the loop are going to become a requirement forever.
Right.
In the AI field. Because somebody has to write the algorithm. Somebody has to monitor what the AI is doing. So you're always going to need people in the loop to monitor what the AI is doing. Fascinating. Good stuff. Well, Eric, thank you very much. We appreciate all of your input. Some of it's pretty highfalutin, but I love this sort of stuff. So until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.today. That's mindmatters.today. Mind Matters is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.
Also, there is one point I wanted to make that I didn't end up making. It's that there's nothing a Turing machine can do that a human cannot do.
Oh, I wish you'd have said that. That would be cool. Yeah.
Yeah, because people assume there's a difference in the realm. So if there are some things that humans can do that computers cannot, there's also things that computers can do that humans cannot.
But humans can do them if we had enough time, because heck, we're the ones that write the algorithms.
Yeah, right.